Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grodi, here at EWTN. And once again, we have this great privilege to come together to hear a story of faith and conversion. We're joined tonight by Tish Oxenrider. She's a former evangelical and Anglican. I'm really honored to have her here tonight to share her story. Tish, thanks for being here tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
It's an honor to have you and to hear your story. Well, let's go back to the beginning.
Okay.
Where does it all begin for you?
Yeah. I grew up in a Protestant home that was filled with church-going parents, church-going grandparents, cousins, aunts, uncles. I was surrounded by church. We started off going to, well, when I was younger, it was a Nazarene church, so kind of a little country church right out. I grew up in Austin, Texas. So this is back when Austin was not the huge Austin it is now. So it was a little country church, but my parents had grown up Pentecostal and Assemblies of God. And so that's where I think the draw to the Nazarene church came. But it wasn't long until, I want to say maybe I was 8, 9, we started going to just an evangelical, non-denominational church. And so that's what I count as my formative upbringing, because that's really where I learned what it even means to be a Christian. But I say all that to say my parents' background affected my background because it affected the type of house I grew up in.
Yeah.
So they loved the evangelical church we went to, the Bible church we went to, because it was really devoted to scripture and exegesis and really unpacking the word and, you know, those sorts of approaches to learning about who God was. It was very sola scriptura kind of church. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm actually very grateful for the church I grew up in.
For sure.
I learned the Bible backwards and forwards. You know, my youth group years were spent with highlighters and colored pencils and circling the words and looking them up in the concordance and all that. So,
yeah, a great blessing.
It's hugely formative for me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, so, I mean, you were involved, obviously, with the Bible study and all that. Did you, at that point, did you have a sense of a relationship with God? Had you kind of had that conversion?
Officially, I would count my first encounter with God being more than just, you know, historic story out of the Bible when I was 13.
Okay.
So it was your classic, I mean, it almost feels like a cliche, but it was a classic church camp story.
Yeah.
It was literal church camp in the summer. And I remember one evening the gospel was presented in a way that just finally hit me that it had something to do with me, that it wasn't just an interesting story.
Right.
I think until then it would just, it wasn't like I thought this has nothing to do with me. It just didn't cross my mind. It was cultural, you know, it was just part of my family's and my, you know, my friends' cultural experience. But it was then that I recognized, oh, this whole death and resurrection of Jesus actually has implications on my life. And it meant something not only to me, but that it cost Christ something. So therefore, it should affect my day-to-day life. So that was the summer. I guess it was the summer I turned 14. So I was entering high school. And so high school was the era when I really actually started becoming active in my faith, I guess is the way to put that. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, what did that look like?
Well, I was really involved in the youth group. So this was, we're talking early 90s.
Okay.
And I've run into all sorts of people that maybe have had a similar experience. It was that classic early 90s youth group. I actually had a fantastic youth pastor. All my best friends came from the youth group. That was where my life revolved, really. You know, I went to a public high school that was good, and I had friends there, but I would call my best friends from church. We were there, you know, Wednesdays and Sundays. I was involved in leadership. My parents actually ran a Bible study out of our house, had been doing so since I was too young to be in the youth group. And so, you know, back in those days, I would be in the back room getting to watch, you know, the Wednesday night TV shows while they were out there doing Bible study with the cool teenagers. So whenever I was old enough to join, I finally got involved and ended up kind of taking a lay leadership position in a way among my peers and in that kind of sense. And so I think that formation led me to look at my public high school as a mission field.
Right.
That's what I thought of as my main job to do there. You know, academics were fairly easy for me. So I did the work, I showed up, but I looked at a lot of my peers. I don't want to call them projects. That wasn't, I really did you know, think of them as human beings. Yeah. But there was something about the church I went to that was also very missional that gave me this vision for the mission field wherever we were. And so, you know, I was editor of the school paper and was in all these honors classes. And so I kind of spent some of my time trying to be a lay evangelist as best I could. Mm-hmm. So that was my formative perspective of what it meant to be a Christian.
Right.
Right.
All right. Well, what happened next?
Well, so after that, well, interestingly, when I was in 10th grade, I went on a mission trip to Russia with my youth group. So this was, we're talking early 90s, like 93. The wall had just come down. And so it was still a wild experience to go to Russia. You know, I'm looking back now as a parent, and I think, wow, my parents, they let me, I mean, it was with the youth group, but still, that was hugely formative for me in that it widened my horizons to, oh, the world is big. And the world is old and has a history and is, you know, people have different ways of thinking, even Christians. I think that was my first experience meeting other Christians that were maybe not quite like me. I came home from that and put that in my back pocket and really just let that kind of simmer in the background, along with my annual Mexico mission trips, you know, from Texas. That's just what we did for spring break. So when I went to college, I went to the University of Texas and majored in English literature because I also loved to read and write and assumed maybe I would do something with that. But about halfway through, I decided to double major in cultural anthropology because God had just, I think, put a bug in me for missions. Mm-hmm. I think just those previous experiences maybe were doing something in me. So that I just wanted to learn more about various cultures and the church, you know, still the church I had grown up in, because it was so missional, it had this really good, I guess, missions formation program where it really believed part of its job as a local church was also to send out missionaries both locally and globally. And so I wanted to maybe leave that door open at least. And so in college, I prayed about that. I considered whether that was something God wanted me to do. And so after college, right the summer after college, I started looking into what would be kind of considered short-term missions, but for a year, because that was sort of the length of time where we could test out, like, is this the thing you wanted to do? Mm-hmm. So long story short, I ended up going to Kosovo. Soon after that, we're talking late 90s, 99, 2000. I first went for a summer and then came back and decided to go for a bit longer. And that season of my life was really, it formed my my perspective on what it meant to be a Christian. I was around some, I mean, still Protestants, but those from other denominations, maybe.
I was going to ask you about that. Up to this point in your life, like, where did other Christian groups fit in your worldview?
I knew of lots of other ones. I called myself a non-denominational Christian. Okay. You know, I can look back now and see, like, what does that mean? That's kind of a denomination in itself. But because the church I grew up in was non-denominational, kind of a Bible church, which to me, you know, I remember our pastor even saying, we're kind of like Baptists. I had Baptist friends in college. I had other non-denom friends, a lot of evangelical free friends. So that's kind of the world I just knew. So it was a lot of, you know, just broad brush evangelical. Right. But when I went on the mission field, I joined a team that was spearheaded by Christians that would call themselves more like Church of Christ or Christian churches, like capital C. And the differences with them, it was subtle, but surprising, a little bit more of an emphasis on the sacraments. And that was news to me. You know, I was baptized when I was 16. You know, this was a believer's baptism where, you know, they don't pressure you until you're fully ready. And my youth pastor, you know, baptized me. And it was actually even more out of obedience. Like, well, it looks like Jesus says to do so in the Bible. So I guess I should. I don't really understand why. This seems a little strange. But okay, that was my perspective of the sacraments at that time.
Sure.
But these missionaries that were wonderful people, and we seemed to have a similar theological background, the differences were, you know, whenever someone in Kosovo would decide to become a Christian, one of the first things they would do is baptize them. And I thought, huh, that's interesting.
Did the Church of Christ have a, I mean, did they express a particular theology of what the sacraments did? Like, well, was baptism efficacious for them?
Well, yeah. And that's kind of what I wondered. Looking back now, I believe there was a little bit of efficacy to the sacrament, but I'm not exactly sure whether they would call that. You know what? I bet you they would, looking back now, say that that's the moment of salvation. Okay. Because I remember there being kind of some running jokes of like, oh, they profess, we better hurry and baptize them in case something happens. Ha, ha, ha.
Yeah.
You know, so I would say so. But then we would have communion every Sunday. But it was definitely, you know, around the kitchen table, grape juice and cracker type of communion. So it was definitely different. But the church I grew up in, we did it once a month.
Yeah.
And
certainly it's just a symbol.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, real quick before we go on, again, you mentioned identifying as non-denominational, different Christians, kind of broad strokes there. Where was the Catholic Church even on the radar? And what was it, a negative, positive, neutral sort of a thing?
The funny thing is the Catholic Church was only on my radar as a mission field. Because of the missions perspective of the church I grew up in, we focused on the 1040 window. I don't know if that's ever been...
What does that mean?
That's a term used, I think, in evangelical circles where it's the longitudinal lines of the globe where the fewest people are Christians. So the 1040 window covers the world that, you know, is kind of around the equator, such. And so that would be the focus of where we wanted to send most people onto the field. But there were other areas as well. It just so happened that within the 1040 window, it tended to be largely Muslim, some Buddhist, some, you know, animistic kind of religions, but mostly those. But there were some others that some people were sent out to the field for, one of which was Catholics.
Right.
And so in the youth group, we actually had some teachings on like the big five religions, you know, of the world for evangelical purposes. And I remember actually studying Catholicism and here's why they are a mission field and why, you know, we need to reach out to them. And so there would be countries that were predominantly Catholic that were considered for sure mission fields. Right. And I remember just praying, like, is that what I'm sent to? I don't know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, kind of funny to think back on. So, yeah, no, so it was never on my radar as a thing, not even remotely, you know,
So, but you had this encounter with the Church of Christ.
Yeah.
And that got you thinking perhaps a little bit?
Maybe. I think it was more.
Just, it was a different experience.
Yeah. More of a different experience, right. Yeah. The benefit, the biggest benefit of going to Kosovo was meeting my husband. So that's where we met. So we met in this tiny little village in the middle of nowhere, 2 kilometers from the Serbian border. One day, you know, you can point out the Americans from 50 feet away. And so we met. We can, like, put an X on the ground where we met. And from then, you know, we ended up dating and marrying not too long after that, both having come back to the U.S. because our stints in Kosovo were finite. You know, we were there for a certain amount of time.
Was he with a different group? You know?
Yeah. He was Baptist.
Ah. Okay.
And so we shared similar...
Yeah.
Theologies and our missions organizations were very similar and had worked together in other fields. So, you know, they were, we were very used to kind of commingling. So we got married. But the key there is we started our family assuming we would be lifelong missionaries. That was just both of us sensed a calling. It's not like we had to convince each other, you know. So we ended up, I don't know, a few years into our marriage, we had our firstborn. And when she was 2, we moved to Turkey. And so we moved to Izmir, Turkey, the biblical city of Smyrna. And I spent most of my time there raising little kids because my daughter was 2, got pregnant with our second a few months after moving there. And then, you know, it was largely that season of life for me. But that experience for us was hugely formative, mostly because of Turkey itself and how... I mean, how old it is, but I remember when we rented our apartment, this high-rise apartment in Izmir overlooking the Aegean, our realtor telling us, you know, there are 20 layers of civilization below you in this apartment building, which blew my American mind. Like, that doesn't even compute. What do you mean? you know. And we would say, like, oh, yeah, the early church is here. That's pretty cool, right? And, you know, just kind of think, gosh, that's interesting. We yeah. would, Ephesus was an hour away. We would drive there and whenever we'd have visitors come. My daughter, for her third birthday party, I remember in downtown Izmir, of all places, we had her birthday party at McDonald's, which that's not a thing we do, but it was just an easy place. And so I remember looking out the window at the McDonald's. It was a two-story McDonald's and looking down and there was a little placard outside and it was the spot where St. Polycarp was martyred.
Wow.
And I thought, huh, who is that?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know anything about it. So I looked him up later and I thought, oh, okay. So this was the home of a lot of stuff, you know, a lot of church history that I'm standing on almost like hallowed ground here at this McDonald's, you know. Mm-hmm. So for a lot of reasons, we ended up leaving the mission field sooner than we thought after about 3.5 years, mostly due to health reasons for one of our kids. And that left us back in the U.S. sort of kind of unmoored, you know. We had learned so much about our experience in both Kosovo and Turkey, Muslim majority cultures, but with a lot of history and recognizing that we no longer felt at home in either church settings that we had grown up in, and we couldn't really pinpoint why.
Huh.
Yeah. And so we came back. We still worked for a missions organization, but stateside for a while. And we moved, my husband's from Oregon, so we moved there for a while. And then ended up moving back. But about when my youngest was 4, we ended up traveling around the world for a school year. Both he and I at this time could work from anywhere. He was working for the missions organization. I had become a writer by then, writing on the internet. I had written some books. I was going to continue writing books. And so we thought, well, our kids are young. Let's take this opportunity and work from anywhere for a year. So we did. So we lived out of a backpack each and traveled. And, you know, sometimes we joke that we would love to do that again, this time as Catholics, because we'd love to experience that. But I think that was just another huge, huge drop in our bucket of the church is really global. And
right.
and so much of how we grew up is, as Christians, is very American culturally.
Yeah.
The church experience we had.
Yeah, the universality of the church, the history of the church. Until you have those encounters, sometimes it's easy to be very local and very temporary.
Unintentionally.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking anything. I wasn't going to church thinking, here I am being an American evangelical Christian. Mm-hmm. I thought it was just being a Christian, you know.
Right.
And so, yeah, my eyes were opened to how, you know, what church was like in Asia, in Africa, in Europe. Yeah. So that was a huge experience. And so when we came back, because we really did not feel at home anymore in our evangelical church settings, we started going to a local Anglican church. Some of our other friends who were on the mission field prior to us started going to an Anglican church. And we thought, this kind of seems like maybe a soft place to land because of its... it had a more rooted timelessness to it, you know, that we felt more comfortable in.
And what did you make of the liturgy? Because obviously this manner of worship and of a Sunday service would have looked very different from what you grew up with.
Yeah. But back when we were preparing for the mission field, I remember one time one of our projects in this training we went to was to go visit a church different than your own. And so this was in Colorado. We ended up visiting an Anglican church one time. And I was surprised how much I loved it. It was very evangelical still, but the call and response, the saying of the old things really stirred something in me that I did not expect at all. And so I had thought about that for years, even back in Turkey. I had thought about that one little Anglican church experience. So when we started visiting this church that our other friends were going to, it brought back all these memories that I had kind of suppressed. And I personally... instantly loved it. My husband did too. I think he maybe took a little bit more to come around, but I loved being able to say something that I sensed was so much older than myself that wasn't contingent on how I felt that Sunday morning and wasn't even contingent on, I mean, this sounds weird, but almost whether I 100%, not that I didn't believe it, but that I understood it. Mm-hmm. You know, I could recite the Nicene Creed and trust that this is something that a great many people much smarter than me had been saying for centuries, and that I could join them.
Right.
And in response to that, so it became exactly what we needed. And I am very grateful for that experience.
Yeah. What was the name of the church?
It was Christ Church in Austin. Okay. Yeah. Christ Church in Austin. And we eventually, they started a little church plant, you know, somewhere just outside of town. I mean, still in town, but closer to home. So we joined this church plant, Church of the Cross, mm-hmm. soon after. And again, full of friends, like-minded people. We were very grateful for that time. And so we were there for a few years, and our kids were baptized there. So, you know, we were all in. We were confirmed Anglican. It seemed exactly where we needed to be. Mm-hmm. I could look back now and see what God was doing,
right,
you know,
right.
But we thought we were going to be there lifelong.
Yeah.
I also, you know, as a writer, strangely, a little bit of an Anglophile. Mm-hmm. And so to me, mm-hmm. there was some sort of connection, like, I love C.S. Lewis. He was Anglican. This is great. I love all things, you know, British. It felt really kind of cool to connect to that cultural touchstone. So, yeah, I love being Anglican.
I forgot to mention earlier, your website is tishoxenrider.com. That's TSHOXENRIDER.com. We'll have that up on the thing. But what kind of writing were you doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I had started writing back in Turkey. Mm-hmm. It's a whole other story, but I was recommended. I had suffered from postpartum depression, we can look back mm-hmm. on. And so one of a therapist I had met with suggested finding a creative outlet while we were living in Turkey, something that had nothing to do with adapting to the culture there, you know, something I could do from home with little kids. And Kyle, my husband, had reminded me that I'd always loved to write. Maybe you should start one of those blog things. Mm-hmm. You know, this was in that era when blogs were just becoming a thing. Yeah. So I started writing just about our life as expats. Mm-hmm. So cross-cultural living, which led to a little bit more of like a genre called simple living, which is kind of hard to explain, like minimalism,
sure.
because that was just sort of a byproduct of how we had to live.
Right.
And it found an audience. I generally say right time, right place, you know, but then it morphed into a little bit more of a broader idea of like, what does it mean to live a good life?
Yeah.
So it became a form of evangelism a little bit. So books ended up revolving around that. It was definitely part of my, I don't know, it was an unexpected career because I was becoming this read author, you know, in the Protestant world. All my publishers were evangelical publishers. And so that became later on, you know, a little bit of that story of like, ooh, is this going to be something I need to relinquish? But I ended up writing a book, a travel narrative memoir about our year traveling as a family, and some fiction too.
That's neat.
Yeah.
And so, but you mentioned though the kind of the literary connection with the Anglicanism, also connected to that great community, you know, of Lewis and Chesterton and Newman, others, you know, who, you know, some of them Catholic, some of them converts, some of them, you know, just right on the edge. You know, definitely different territory.
Yeah, for sure. Yet I felt at home with all those guys. And actually, you know, it was reading people like Chesterton, even just knowing Tolkien as a Catholic, that I found myself drawn towards thinkers that tended to skew Catholic accidentally. Like, you know, one of my favorite modern writers is Peter Kraft.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, I remember us doing a book study of his back in my youth group in the 90s. And I remember thinking, I remember this guy's name. And my youth pastor even saying, this is a great guy. Now, guys, he's Catholic. Just letting you know. Just take that with a grain of salt, but he's a great writer. But it almost came across like, gosh, everyone smart that I tended to agree with was Catholic. That's funny, you know? And so we really appreciated our Anglican church, but as we got used to the liturgy, as we got used to just what we did on a Sunday morning, I remember just started to ask deep down a little bit like, okay, why? And where does this come from? Are we just doing traditional old things for the sake of them being traditional and old?
Right.
And, you know, I like traditional. I like old.
Yeah.
That's okay. But then at some point, it really started niggling at me a little more like, but why?
Yeah.
And really the question I would ask would be like, says who? And that question just really kind of chewed away at me, like, says who?
Yeah. Well, that's perhaps a good place to take a quick break. And we'll pick it back up there with that That question, yeah. Says who? Yeah. I love that. We'll be back in just a few minutes, so stay tuned to hear the rest of Tish's story. I want to remind you that if you are thinking about becoming Catholic, if you have questions about the Catholic Church, if you go to chnetwork.org, we have a whole archive of resources, videos, and articles to help you on that journey. But even perhaps more importantly, we have people who'd love to hear your story, pray with and for you. We have a newsletter. We have a digital community of converts and journeyers. Again, people who are asking similar questions who have asked those similar questions, been on a similar journey to you. And again, we just want to help each other take the next right step in following Christ. And so check that all out at chnetwork.org. We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Tish's story. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with Tish Oxenrider. She's a former evangelical and Anglican. And I mentioned it briefly before the break, but your website is tishoxenrider.com. We'll put that up on the screen, tshoxenrider.com. But if people want to connect with you there, what will they find at your website?
Yeah, that is my landing spot for all sorts of things
sure.
that I do.
Yeah.
So I've written, I think, 6 books at the time I'm talking to you,
yeah.
a couple more on the way. My newsletter is where I tend to write okay. more frequently. I send out a newsletter about once a week. Okay. People can find it there. I also do a podcast. Mm-hmm. I speak to people a lot in near weekly episodes. So you can find just links mm-hmm. to all of that stuff there.
And what sorts of topics?
Very broad okay. questions of what do you find true, good, and beautiful? Ah, so awesome. It's all sorts of people and all sorts of walks of life, and it's very edifying.
Well, you mentioned during the break you have a book coming out, connected to the rule of life. Did I get that
uh-huh.
right?
Oh. Uh-huh. Benedictine spirituality. Yep, yep.
That's
and
really cool.
Writing a rule of life for the modern age and
yeah.
for the lay person.
Yep. I love that. Very, really important stuff.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get back to your story.
Yeah.
Again, when we left off, let's see. You guys are going to the Anglican Church. You're appreciating it. But this question, I love the way you phrased it. You know, like, is all this old stuff, this traditional stuff, is it just an aesthetic? You know, or but says who, right?
Yeah.
And why do we do this? Why are we doing this? So
yeah.
What happened next?
Yeah, and in some ways, that's a very American question. You know, we're individualists. And, mm-hmm. and I found myself, you know, in all our travels and all our missions experiences, just rubbing up to my American culture of, like, I want to do it my way. And so in many ways, becoming Anglican was a little bit of that, like, I'm going to do it my way. And so it felt almost like a bit of a rebellion from my Bible church evangelical upbringing to become Anglican, just because, you know, it was just so different than my experience of going to church growing up. And yet that won't keep you there. You know, there's only so much rebellion one can continue to do until you just find yourself rebelling against yourself, I guess, at some point. And so I just started asking these questions. My husband was on a slightly different journey of asking questions, but we would both agree that just something was like, we enjoy the people. We want to raise our kids in a church. So we're sticking with this, but deep down there was just stuff that didn't quite settle with us. So I just started doing research. I love research, you know, in my books and, just kind of a nerd. And so I would just start looking things up and found, you know, once you start asking questions, you can go down a rabbit trail. And so I found a lot of resources. You know, Peter Kraft was definitely one. And some of those guys like Newman and Chesterton really spoke to me. Especially Chesterton, really, because he was such a lucid. I loved his writing. He was so lucid and funny and clearly smart. And he converted. What was it that convinced him? And then even modern day thinkers and writers and resources, you know, some of the podcasts out there, I would type in my question into Google and find a direct answer from, you know, the Catholic Answers guys. Or I found Thomas Howard's episode of talking with your dad, I believe. And that really struck a nerve with me because I had grown up reading Elizabeth Elliot and then really appreciated their whole family and then read a little of Thomas Howard and it's like, he became Catholic? What in the world? You know, and so I watched his story, I ended up watching a few other conversion stories mm-hmm. and that was really helpful. And I just couldn't get enough. I kind of felt like I was I don't know, seeing things with new eyes. And, you know, once you ask one question, you have to ask another and then another. I remember some of my early questions had to do with kind of the broad stuff. You know, what about the weird Mary stuff? Or what's up with transubstantiation? And all those questions would be answered in a way that's like, okay, well, maybe except for the Marian doctrines, that was still one of my big hangups, but transubstantiation made sense. You know, if Jesus could walk on water and I believed that, mm-hmm. why couldn't I believe that he actually did become, you know, the host that mm-hmm. those Catholics, you know, claim to be Jesus every week. Yeah. But it all felt like all those questions were pointing ultimately to still says who, like yeah. who's saying all this stuff? Or just, is it a bunch of just smart people sitting around and deciding this is true? Well, they're smart Protestants, you know, and they say otherwise. So what makes them different? You know, is it just a battle of the minds here? Is it a battle of, you know, what we want to be true?
Yeah. So, well, yeah. And so many of the things, interesting, because thinking about transubstantiation, Christ's miracles, and even his incarnation, right? Like if he has the power, obviously he does have the power to become man, to take on flesh. Well, obviously he has the power to make the bread and wine into his body and blood. The question is, did he,
yeah.
right? Is that what he did?
Yes.
And so the question of authority becomes paramount because it's like, yeah, certainly lots of these hypotheses could be true.
Right.
But which one is?
Right. And yeah, it was a little bit of that. Why would Jesus want us to eat his flesh and drink his blood? That seems really weird. Is that what he said in John 6? Mm-hmm. Of course, asking that question led me to, you know, a lot of other people like Scott Hahn mm-hmm. and listening to The Fourth Cup and mm-hmm. listening to it again because I didn't understand it the first time and listening to it three more times and just it blowing my mind and recognizing, okay, this Bible that I thought I knew backwards and forwards, thanks to my upbringing, is saying new things. You know, it's living and active. So, hey, maybe I'm just, you know, as we all mature learning new things, but no, it was saying different things that I didn't see before. I didn't see the typology before. I didn't see, what was going on when he called Peter the rock. I mean, I knew that, but it didn't cross my mind. Looking back now, when you have hindsight, you're like, how did I not know? But I think it was just the goodness and grace of God just showing me little, you know, just kind of yeah. the little pebble trail that once I followed one, I had to keep going and keep going. And so it led me ultimately to that question of like, was Peter the first pope, as they say? And what does pope even mean? Because I had still, you know, I was shedding as many Catholic assumptions as I was gathering answers. I didn't even realize I had so many Catholic assumptions that were taught to me growing up, but I don't think by ill-willed people.
Right.
You know, I don't think anyone, in fact, I don't think most Protestants are sitting around thinking we're Protestant. You know,
right.
we're sitting around protesting the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. I think they just think they're Christians and that yeah. Catholics added a bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so when I recognized, oh, the Pope, when they call the Pope infallible, they're not saying he's perfect. I think I grew up just assuming those Catholics, they think there's this other guy besides Jesus who's walking around sinless. And that doesn't sit well with me. And when I recognized, no, that's not what's meant by by Pope at all. And that Peter could actually be the first pope. What does that mean? Why do we need some kind of hierarchical structure like that? Why is the church both visible and invisible? And for my specific situation, does the Anglican Church have apostolic succession? And so I remember even like trying to look it up, you know, trying to find those, you know, charts.
Yeah.
And okay, what does the Anglican Church teach? And interestingly, being part of the Anglican Church of North America, that is kind of an offshoot of the Episcopalian Church, but mm-hmm. also was the version of the Anglican Church of England. You know, there's a lot of branches.
Right.
So there isn't even one clear definitive answer even among Anglicans. And so I remember asking for a brief meeting, you know, a friendly meeting with our priest, if I could just like toss him some questions. And one of them was, so do we have apostolic succession? And he said, oh yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And explained his answer, explained a few other things. You know, his view was that the Anglican Church got most things right, that if an early church father were to be, you know, put in a time machine and brought to the present day, he'd feel most comfortable in the Anglican Church, that the Catholics have since added a bunch of things. So that plus his answer of apostolic succession, I got back in my car and just drove away really unsatisfied, thinking I don't see the lineage there, the unbroken succession that you claim is there. But okay, I'm just going to keep thinking about this. But that was the question that kept coming back was, okay, if Christ set up his church hierarchical with particular men, you know, finite human, sinful men like Peter, to lead his church, and then if he didn't want it to end with the death of the apostles, then clearly there would need to be other men who's, you know, who would be anointed to take on the jobs, that should mean that's still going on.
Right.
And so that became my big bugaboo, I guess, being Protestant, like, wait, the answer to says who is, I don't think us. I don't think how we're doing it. Definitely not me. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to find the says who. And perhaps it doesn't have anything to do with their character, their, you know, who they are as people. You know, as I just started learning history, I was like, yeah, there were some bad popes, some really bad popes.
Right.
And yet the church is still around. You know, that quote from Hilaire Belloc about the knavish imbecility, you know, if it were, it wouldn't have lasted a fortnight unless it was divine. I'm butchering it, but it was that idea.
Well, it's a real miracle of history, right?
Yeah.
Precisely because of the scandals and bad popes and bishops and priests and lay people, mea culpa, right? Somehow it is still here, right?
Yeah.
In a continuity that we don't see really elsewhere in other institutions.
Right, yeah. Right. And so when I started to become more satisfied with the answer of, you know, that Christ did seem to set up his church to be visible mm-hmm. with hierarchy, and that there is a line of apostolic succession, then the question started becoming a little more applicable. So what about us? What does that mean? Oh, gosh, that implies something.
Right.
Yeah.
And where was your husband with these questions?
He was great with me just asking and answering them. He knows my personality to be sort of the researching type.
Yeah.
And so, you know, dinner time, it was great discussion fodder,
yeah.
You know. He was unsatisfied with where things were. He just wasn't sure where the answers lied. Mm-hmm. And he was really intrigued by the answers I was finding, but wasn't sure what to do about them either.
Yeah.
And so he was content just to hear my answers. But then early 2020, a little pandemic hit, and suddenly we weren't meeting anymore, going to church. And we can look back now and, you know, we felt honestly a little badly thinking this, but at the time it felt like we have more freedom now to maybe explore other ways of doing church. You know, our church met virtually, but we could also live stream one of those Catholic masses. You know, we have never been to a Catholic mass. Mm-hmm. We hardly knew any Catholics. We were like, let's check that out. And so my husband, Kyle, we went on a walk during the pandemic, and I just told him, look, I am really feeling this pull towards Catholicism as much as I'm fighting it. You know, I don't want to be Catholic.
Yeah.
And yet I find myself being drawn towards it. And he said, yeah, me too. I'm with you. Let's really start looking into this thing. And so we started looking for just online masses of sorts that we could participate in as a family, and called up our local parish. And, you know, it was on lockdown, but within a few months, they had opened up their RCIA classes again. So we just thought, okay, we can just go and see what all the fuss is about. You know, it's a 5-minute drive from our house. There's no, you know, loss in going. So we started going to RCIA just to hear some of our questions answered. And, you know, I know everyone has wildly different experiences
right.
with RCIA.
Mm-hmm.
Ours, you know, there were good people and great priests there. But we found ourselves feeling a little bit like the scratches weren't being, or that our itches weren't being scratched because our questions had much more to do with, like, you know, okay, we agree with all these, you know, 95% of what you're saying. Let's get to the weird Catholic stuff. Let's get to the indulgences and purgatory and Mary.
Mm-hmm.
But those first very long weeks in RCIA were, you know, fundamentally foundational questions like, who is God and who is Jesus? And we agreed with all that. So I remember just telling, I think I even, sounds so, you know, 21st century, but I think I remember tweeting about this. And I had a mutual writer friend, Andrew Petiprin.
Oh, yeah.
Who at the time, yeah. I think he's been with you at some point.
Yeah.
And so he DM'd me on Twitter. And he said, hey, have you considered The Ordinariate? And I said, I had heard of that, but what is that? And so Andrew is a former Anglican priest who had filled me in on what this was. And funnily enough, the cathedral was just a few hour drive from us in Houston, you know?
And for those who don't know what The Ordinariate is.
Yeah. So The Ordinariate, and it's still even a little hard to explain, but it was set up by Pope Benedict the 16th as a way for, I guess what was happening at the time was entire Anglican and Episcopal parishes were wanting to become Catholic en masse. Yeah. And he saw that this was a real need and created, as a grace, the Ordinariate as a form of, as a way for people to become fully Catholic, yet hold on to their Anglican patrimony.
Right.
And so it's the old ordinary, or it's the old Anglican rites that were fully Catholic.
Yeah.
Restored, basically.
It's really amazing. Again, as a side note, especially for we who are a little bit Anglophiles, right? It's a very beautiful liturgy to experience.
Oh, it's and so for me, I felt like all these signs were just like pointing towards, okay, this is the path for you. I had never even heard of this, and suddenly here we go. You know, Kyle and I would even joke like the church has a Disney fast pass to becoming Catholic for us Anglicans. That's amazing. And so, he connected me with the priest over at the cathedral in Houston. And funnily enough, also on Twitter, also a podcaster, Father Jonathan Michigan. And we reached out to him and just told him our situation. You know, it still being the pandemic, he said, how about we just Zoom a couple times a month and you just read the catechism? So read the catechism. And then whenever we meet, ask your questions. And so that became our RCIA. Wow. So
awesome.
During 2020, that's how we met. We met sometimes once a week, sometimes every couple of weeks. And that way we could get to like, okay, yes, we agree with this. I was floored by, I mean, that could be a whole other conversation. The catechism itself, how beautifully rich it was.
Really.
And the fact that there were answers, you know, like, oh, I could point to something. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just guys who decided one thing and then 10 years later they changed their theology. Like, no, this is, I could definitively say what the church teaches about something. That was such a gift. But we could go straight to the heart of some of our final questions. And so that was a huge gift, because then we would then pass on like what we were learning to our kids who were teenagers, or at least our older two were teenagers at this time. So it wasn't that, you know, we were just going to have them blindly join us without any questions. And it was late December in 2020 when Father Jonathan finally said, I think you guys are ready. Not, and when I say that, I don't mean all your questions are answered.
Right.
I just mean you can continue asking some of your questions, but I sense that it is time. And Kyle and I prayed about it, and it became, for me, ultimately an issue of obedience and submission, to where I recognized I would actually be not in, I would be disobeying if I did not, you know, become Catholic. And you know, I joke to this day, if a 16-year-old youth group me would have told me I would have become Catholic, I would have put myself on a prayer list. You know, I would be the last person I would assume would become Catholic. But so we put a date on the calendar for whenever the cathedral would be available during, you know, lockdown still. And so it was early February. And so that gave us about 6 weeks to really prepare our hearts and minds and get our kids ready with this. And we decided, okay, we're going to do this as a family. Our daughter was just shy of 16. So that's definitely a formative age where you're making your own decisions. And she agreed, but wasn't fully, you know, fully, I don't want to say convinced, but, you know, understanding it all, but was willing. Mm-hmm. And so, February 6th, 2021, we all came into the church in a confirmation mass, just us and our sponsors, in a beautiful cathedral. And I remember afterwards, Kyle and I, like one of the first things we said was, it feels so relieving not to be our own popes anymore. That was the phrase we used. We were just tired of being our own popes, of trying to decide, what did we believe? Did we believe this or that? Was this true or not? And recognizing, actually, God didn't call us to make those decisions. It's a grace that he gave us a church. Not to check our brains in at the door where we didn't get to ask questions, even push back on on struggles that we have about some of the church's teachings, but to recognize like, oh, that's not my calling, that God didn't ask us each to decide, you know, what was true and what wasn't. That's not how he set it up when he called Peter the rock.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, beautiful. Well, yeah. What's happened since then?
Well, a lot. You know, one of the first, Keith Nestor, a great guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. He gave me some of the best piece of advice, you know, especially as somebody who's on the internet. Mm-hmm. Your first year as a Catholic, just focus on being a better Christian. Mm. When it comes to your parents, you know, both of our parents were not happy about this. Both sets of parents. Our friends, all mostly still Protestant. Do not start wearing the hat of an apologist. And that was really good wisdom from Keith.
Yeah.
And so we just focused on our inner formation. We started becoming involved in the new Anglican, ordinariate. We're not even yet a parish. We're a parish in formation in our local Central Texas area. And that's been a gift because 95% of us are all converts. Mm-hmm. And that's become where we've met some of our great friends now, yeah. So we don't feel so alone. And I continue to write. I continue to teach, you know, students. Kyle continues to run his business. We've never been so at peace with exactly where we know God has us now as Catholics. Mm-hmm. And we still ask questions, you know, we're still learning, like, wait, why does the church teach that? That's unusual, you know, or, you know, we still have phrases like, Catholics are weird, man. You know, whenever we run into stuff, you know, I lead pilgrimages.
Oh, cool.
Once a year, and they've become rather ecumenical, a lot of Protestants, about half and half mm-hmm. now. And so it's been a fun experience getting to go to certain places and unpack for them, you know, what are these relics, or why do certain places, you know, hold a little bit of a sacred meaning, you know, here on earth? What does it mean to be fully embodied? That was something that I really loved about the Catholic Church, is that it taught that we have purpose to our bodies, purpose to places, purpose mm-hmm. to our life on earth, that they're not just, you know, we're not just brains on sticks, which I don't think my Protestant upbringing meant to teach us, but it kind of did in a way. And so pilgrimages have become a real source of encouragement in that regard, and form of evangelism in a way.
Yeah.
And also just good-willed dialogue between Christians. And so I'm grateful for that experience, too.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
We've got about 7 minutes left, and I wanted to circle back around on a couple of things. Again, you mentioned a couple times, you know, the Catholic weird stuff, you know, weird things that Catholic.
Yeah.
You know, a couple of them that you'd mentioned, you know, were things like indulgences, purgatory, and the Mary stuff in particular.
Yeah.
You know, any of those that you would like to kind of share the evolution of your thinking or how you kind of came to grips with them?
Yeah, you know, I had no problem with Mary as Theotokos, you know, in my mind, Mother of God, of course. It was harder, the Assumption and perpetual virginity, those later doctrines, mm-hmm. Because there weren't in the Bible, mm-hmm. at least the way I read it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't quite understand the point. Like, why does it matter whether she was assumed into heaven or whether she was a perpetual virgin? And so as a lay person, you know, not someone who can unpack all those theologies, but as someone who loves to learn, I would read and hear, you know, smart people explain it and think, okay, that sort of makes sense, a little bit strange still. But I think it was John Henry Newman's Development of Doctrine mm-hmm. that really settled the issue for me in that regard, because of understanding, oh, the church still teaches that we're not, you know, a common phrase for evangelicals especially, but Protestants is people of the book, mm-hmm. you know, and so sometimes we tend to think of Christianity is just all back then,
right.
you know, basically ending with the book of Acts. Mm-hmm. And so we just continue to study that and not recognizing, like, actually, there are ecumenical councils that define doctrine mm-hmm. and didn't redefine it, but continue to unpack and explain. Yeah. And so when I would ask, like, well, why was that a doctrine not explained till less than a century ago, you know, mm-hmm. something like the Assumption, and recognizing the cultural ramifications that, oh, perhaps that didn't even need to be explained, you know, in the time of, you know, the apostles and Ignatius and Polycarp and all those guys, because right. it was just so assumed. And when I'd read the church fathers, right. I would see, oh, there was that assumption. So the Marian doctrines to me ultimately became an act of submission. Mm-hmm. Like, I trust the church's authority. I see how Christ established it.
Yeah.
Even if I don't fully understand why certain things need to be defined in certain ways, yeah. I'm going to submit.
Well, you mentioned a crucial piece of that, which is, yeah, that many things, many Catholic doctrines and doctrines that Christians in general would accept aren't explicitly in Scripture. Yeah. In a way that would fit in a kind of a sola scriptura kind of mindset. The Marian doctrines are some of them, but even like the Trinity, right?
Yeah.
There's no like systematic, clear, concise, you know, definition or formulation of the Trinity. And so what we have is the church pondering these things, like Mary pondering these things in her heart. And then as, you know, heresies arise or questions come up, slowly the implications unfold. And that, but it doubles back on the need for authority, that as the questions come up, we have to know that there's a place we can go that will ensure that as we think this through, what we're coming up with is not just my novel interpretation, not something new, not something that's in conflict with what came before, but something that's in continuity with what was always there.
Correct. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. And how St. Paul even says, you know, these things that we've taught you in word and deed, right? That right. even in the Bible, it actually, you know, and John ending like, that this is not everything that happened, you
right,
know,
right.
That the Bible itself says that, you know, it is not just here in these pages where truth is found. And so, yeah, it really did become eye-opening for me, even the simple recognition, oh, Trinity is not in the Bible, mm-hmm. you know, and of course I believe in the Trinity. Mm-hmm. You know, even where the table of contents of the Bible come from, recognizing, oh, right. That I actually did believe in church authority. I just didn't know I did, you know, and that these things were determined by human beings over the centuries, slowly over time, that even those early church fathers that I would read, whenever they would mention scripture, they weren't referencing the Bible I had on my nightstand because that wasn't even decided yet what mm-hmm. was canon. So, yeah, there's all sorts of interesting realizations along the way like
yeah.
that. Yeah.
Well, we've just got a few minutes left, and so we know that all of this theology, the rubber meets the road in actual practice, actual prayer, actual day-to-day living. And so talk just for a minute, if you could, about what you've discovered in terms mm-hmm. of the Christian life, the practical Christian life, and then share a little bit about the book that you're working on right now.
Yeah. You know, as a former missionary, I think I assumed what my life would look like as a missionary. Turns out, I still am, because we all are, mm-hmm. you know, and that my day-to-day life as a wife, as a mom, as a community member, mm-hmm. As a writer and as a teacher is my mission field. And that because I can point to the church as the authority, I have so much creative freedom to exercise the charisms God has given me, the gifts and the skills God has given me without needing to wonder, like, does this align with my particular mm-hmm. doctrine of the month? Or, you know, I mean, perhaps there's always the concern of like, okay, I want to make sure I'm not believing heresy here, you know, whenever I'm, you know, whatever.
But you've got a starting point, like a firm
yes,
starting point. In the
yes,
church.
There's yeah. something I can point to. Mm-hmm. And so my day-to-day life looks in some ways not that different as mm-hmm. a wife and mom, right? But so much more at peace to, you know, take looking back to Keith's wisdom, like be a better Christian, you know, just exercise yeah. my faith in word and deed, you know, be a light among my neighbors. I teach students and they come from all sorts of backgrounds and continue to learn and grow, you know, pass the faith on to my kids. It looks a lot like, you know, kind of that idea from St. Mother Teresa, who talked about washing the dishes, you know, wash yeah. the dishes because you love the person who will use them next. To me,
yes.
that's what a lot of my evangelism looks like now, along with right. writing the books, you know, that God's allowed me to write. Yeah. So now I'm in the middle of writing two, mm-hmm. One fiction, one nonfiction. Mm-hmm. So the nonfiction book I'm writing on is based on my interest in St. Benedict's Rule of Life. So mm-hmm. back on that trip, that we took now a decade ago with mm-hmm. our family. I actually went to a monastery for a while and spoke with a spiritual director who tuned me in just to St. Benedict's Rule of Life. And I just found it, an interesting piece of literature and history. But since then, it's really become a formative part of my daily life. You know, yeah. what does my particular rule look like within the Benedictine vows of obedience, stability, and conversion, and the five habit practices of prayer, work, study, renewal, and hospitality. And so the book is narratively driven, again, because that's how I write. But what does that look like for a lay person?
Beautiful. I can't wait to read that.
Yeah.
Tish, thanks so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
For your continued work and your writing. We'll be praying for that.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Tish's story was an inspiration to you. We'll be back again next week with another story. But in the meantime, God bless.